Imagine the most famous psychedelic of the 20th century.
Right.
Like, if you're like most people, your mind immediately jumps to a very specific image. You're probably picturing this, I don't know, sterile, glowing Swiss laboratory in the 1940s.
Yeah, the classic bubbling flask.
Exactly, a bubbling flask and the invention of LSD. But what if I told you the blueprint for that exact mind-bending chemical is probably growing on the trellis in your neighbor's backyard right now?
It's wild to think about.
Right. What if nature had already invented LSDs, like older, blunter cousins centuries earlier?
It completely disrupts our modern assumptions about these compounds. I mean, we're so used to viewing psychedelics through this clinical synthetic
Oh,
lens. But
totally.
the molecular architecture we're talking about today is ancient. It was, perfected by nature long before humans even understood what a molecule was.
And that is exactly what we are pulling apart today. We're drawing from a really comprehensive neuroscience article. It was published in the OOTW Journal in July of 2026.
Which is a fantastic piece of research, by the way.
It really is. So, the mission for this deep dive is to explore a molecule known as LSA or ergin. We're going to, uncover its Aztec history, break down its fascinating chemistry, and figure out what this naturally occurring compound teaches us about the incredibly delicate chemical balance of human consciousness.
It's a really compelling narrative
Yeah.
because once you really understand LSA, you realize that the macroscopic reality you experience every day is entirely at the mercy of microscopic shapes.
Yeah.
Just a tiny structural shift on a single molecule can completely rewrite what it feels like to be human.
Okay, let's unpack this because I know when we start throwing around acronyms like LSD and LSA and talking about molecular architecture, it can sound like you need a PhD in pharmacology to keep up.
Right, which you definitely don't.
Exactly, you really don't. You just need to be insanely curious. So let's ground this. Where does LSA actually come from? Because we aren't talking about a fungus grown in a petri dish. We are talking about literal flowers.
We are. Specifically, LSA is found in the seeds of a few particular climbing vines. The most potent common source is a plant called Hawaiian baby woodrose, which goes by the scientific name Argyria nervosa.
Argyria nervosa, got it.
Yeah. And the seeds of this vine are roughly 0.14% LSA by dry weight.
Okay.
But you also find it in much smaller amounts, around 0.02% in common ornamental morning glories. You'd probably recognize the names of the varieties sold at any garden center, like Heavenly Blue or Pearly Gates.
I want to pause on those percentages for a second because 0.14% and 0.02% sound incredibly tiny.
They are.
So, what does that actually mean in terms of a physical seed? Like, if someone were to consume it?
Well, it means concentration matters immensely.
Hmm.
With Hawaiian baby woodrose, because it's at that 0.14% mark, a person might only need to consume maybe 5 to 10 seeds to feel a profound effect.
Wow, just 5 to 10.
Exactly. But with morning glory sitting way down at 0.02%, you would have to consume hundreds of seeds to reach the same threshold.
Hundreds of them. That sounds awful.
It really is.
Yeah.
And as we'll get into later, eating hundreds of raw, fibrous seeds introduces a whole lot of physical misery.
Which is just wild to think about, considering you can buy packets of these at literally any hardware store. But long before they were, draped over suburban fences, these plants had massive spiritual significance.
Oh, absolutely.
The article brings up a 16th century Spanish chronicler and physician named Francisco Hernandez, and he was documenting how Aztec priests were using these exact seeds.
Right, and the historical context here is vital. The Aztecs called the morning glory seeds Oluliuqui, and the black seeds from a related vine were known as Tlilutin.
Okay.
But they weren't using these recreationally. There was no concept of taking this just to, have a good time on a Saturday. They use them as divinatory entheogens.
Meaning they use them to generate a divine experience, like a religious thing.
Precisely.
Yeah.
The priests and healers consume these seeds to commune directly with their gods, to receive visions, and even to diagnose illnesses in their communities. Yeah, it was a deeply sacred technology. Of course, the colonial Spanish authorities saw this and immediately condemned the practice as demonic, basically driving it underground.
Right, as they did with so many indigenous practices.
Exactly. But the ritual use of these seeds quietly survived among indigenous peoples in southern Mexico for centuries.
So, for hundreds of years, this practice is just kept alive in secret, and the outside world has absolutely no idea what chemical is actually causing these visions.
Not at all.
Which brings us to the 1960s. The article mentions that a chemist finally gets his hands on some authentic Aloe Liuqui seeds. Who actually figured this out?
This is honestly one of the great historical plot twists in modern chemistry. The man who finally got the seeds in 1960 and managed to isolate and crystallize the active alkaloids to see what the Aztecs were consuming alongside his colleague Hans Schurter was Albert Hofmann.
Wait, Albert Hofmann, as in the Swiss chemist at Sandoz who invented LSD?
The very same.
Are you kidding me?
Nope.
So Hofmann synthesizes LSD in his lab in 1938. And then 22 years later, he analyzes these ancient Aztec seeds and realizes that nature had basically beaten him to the punch.
That is exactly the realization. When he and Schurter break down the seeds, they make a stunning discovery. The primary active ingredient in the sacred Aztec seeds is lysergic acid, amide LSA.
That's crazy.
They also found its chemical mirror image, an isomer called isoergin, but LSA was the star. The scientific community was actually so baffled by this that initially, other chemists accused Hofmann of contaminating his own samples.
Yeah, they just couldn't believe it wasn't a lab mistake, like he must have spilled some LSD into the seed batch.
Right. They couldn't believe a complex ergot alkaloid, something they associate entirely with fungi in laboratories, was just naturally occurring in a common morning glory vine. It seemed mathematically impossible to be a coincidence.
But his findings held up. There was no contamination.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Hofmann's discovery completely reframed the entire scientific understanding of psychedelics. It proved that his laboratory creation, LSD, wasn't just some synthetic freak of nature isolated from the world.
Yeah.
It was actually a direct relative of a family of sacred Mexican drugs with centuries of ritual context. Nature had been manufacturing the core blueprint the entire time.
Okay, I am fascinated by this blueprint concept, because the chemical relationship connecting an Aztec vine to a Swiss laboratory is where things get really weird.
It really is.
The text talks about this thing called the ergoline skeleton. Can we break down what that actually is?
Sure. Think of the ergoline skeleton as a biological chassis, like the frame of a car.
Okay.
Chemically, it's a specific four-ring structure. And amazingly, nature figured out how to build this exact frame in two completely distinct kingdoms of life.
Wait, really? Two different kingdoms?
Yes. Is produced by a fungus called Claviceps purpurea, which is the ergot fungus that infects rye. And entirely independently, it's produced by these morning glory vines.
That is bizarre.
It's fascinating. From that base chassis, nature builds a whole family of compounds. LSA is basically the stripped-down base model version of that car.
And the relationship between LSA and LSD is almost absurdly direct, right? Like, they are practically the same molecule.
They are staggeringly close. Mm. The full chemical name for LSD is lysergic acid diethylamide. LSA is lysergic acid amide.
Right.
The only difference between them comes down to a tiny modification Hofmann made back in 1938. He took that natural lysergic acid structure and attached two ethyl groups onto what's called the amide nitrogen.
Let's translate that for a second. An ethyl group is just like a tiny cluster of carbon and hydrogen atoms, right?
Yes, exactly. Think of them as two tiny chemical handles attached to the side of the molecule. That is the entire difference between LSA and LSD. Just two microscopic clusters of carbon and hydrogen.
But those two little handles change absolutely everything about how the molecule interacts with the human body. The source text points out this massive potency gap.
Oh, it's huge.
Because of those two ethyl groups, LSD is active in micrograms, like millionths of a gram. But LSA requires milligrams to work. You need roughly 1,000 times more of the substance to get an effect.
And that all comes down to how the molecules fit into the receptors in your brain. Specifically, we're talking about the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
A famous one.
Right. That receptor is essentially the biological doorway that classic psychedelics use to create their effects. LSA binds to that doorway roughly 10 to 20 times more reticulately than LSD does.
So it sounds like LSD is, like a master key.
Yeah.
It's been precision engineered in a lab with those two little ethyl handles acting like perfect grooves, allowing it to slide flawlessly into the brain's psychedelic lock and turn it with zero friction.
That's a really good way to look at it.
So if LSD is the master key, LSA is like a rough draft, like a rusty older key that you really have to jiggle in the lock to get the door open.
The rusty key is a perfect analogy. Because it's a clunkier fit, you have to use more force, meaning more milligrams, to push it into the lock.
Right.
But here's the critical part. While you're struggling to turn that rusty key in the main psychedelic lock, your hand is accidentally bumping into all the other locks on the door.
Oh, wow. What are the other locks?
Well, LSA doesn't just hit the 5-HT2A receptor weakly. It also has a relatively strong affinity for other targets, like the 5-HT1A receptor, alpha-adrenergic receptors, and dopamine D2 sites.
Okay, why does that matter? What happens when you bump into those specific locks?
This is the biological why behind the radically different experience LSA creates. Engaging the 5-HT1A receptor broadly signals the brain to calm down. It's highly sedating.
Interesting.
And when you hit the alpha-adrenergic receptors, you're messing with the autonomic nervous system. That's the background software control your blood vessels, your heart rate, your fight-or-flight response.
Oh, so physical stuff.
Exactly. And dopamine D2 receptors affect movement and mood.
Yeah.
So while LSD's precise master key tilts the nervous system toward a wakeful, hyperlucid, kaleidoscopic state,
right,
LSA's blunt, messy profile tilts the system heavily toward profound sedation, bodily heaviness, and pretty severe physical discomfort.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because we have to talk about what that rusty key actually feels like when it turns. We've established it's not just a weaker LSD trip. It is a qualitatively different lived experience.
Very different.
So let's walk through the timeline. Someone chews up these seeds. According to the data, they're looking at a 20 to 60 minute onset, and the main effects last anywhere from 4 to 8 hours.
Yes, but the lingering effects, particularly the overwhelming drowsiness, can easily stretch out to 12 hours.
12 hours of feeling heavy. Because the defining feature across the board seems to be this crushing sedation. The article uses the clinical term oneric, which translates to a dreamlike state. People describe feeling heavy-limbed.
Right, like moving through molasses.
Yeah. With LSD, people talk about these famously crisp, geometric, open-eye visuals, right? The walls breathing in high definition.
Exactly.
But LSA lacks all of that clarity. It leans way more into muddy, drifting, closed-eye imagery. You aren't seeing the fabric of reality fracture. You're just sort of suspended in this heavy, lethargic half-sleep.
There was actually a German human study on Argyrian nervosa seeds that captured this beautifully. They memorably characterized the psychological effect as sedative narcotic. They even compared the physical heaviness to an anticholinergic drug like scopolamine.
Wait, scopolamine? Isn't that the drug they put in those little patches for seasickness?
It is, in very tiny doses. It works by blocking a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. But in higher doses, scopolamine doesn't give you psychedelic clarity. It causes a heavy delirious stupor.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah. You become intensely lethargic, your mouth dries out, and you experience a sort of waking dream state that is very confusing. The German researchers were saying LSA's physical heaviness closely mimics that kind of delirious stupor. It is fundamentally different from the sharp electric clarity of LSD.
And it's not just the heavy headspace that's difficult. The physical side effects sound absolutely brutal. We're talking about pronounced nausea, intense stomach cramps, and vasoconstriction,
right,
meaning your blood vessels literally tighten up, restricting blood flow and leaving you with cold, tingling hands and feet.
And we have to remember, if someone is eating morning glory seeds, a lot of that nausea is compounded by the plant material itself. You aren't taking pure LSA. You're digesting hundreds of raw fibrous seeds that contain a complex soup of dozens of different alkaloids.
That sounds rough on the stomach.
Extremely.
Mm-hmm.
The physical toll, what the modern psychedelic community calls the body load, is immensely demanding.
Which raises a huge practical question for me. If this experience causes severe nausea, stomach cramps, and just makes you feel heavy and sedated, wait, no. I mean, why would anyone ever take it? What does this tell us about the Aztec willingness to endure that kind of physical misery for a spiritual payoff?
It highlights a massive philosophical divide between modern recreational drug use and historical entheogenic rituals. Today, if someone takes a substance recreationally, they generally want to feel good.
Right.
They want euphoria, energy, or visual entertainment. And any physical discomfort is seen as a completely unwanted side effect.
Mm-hmm.
But in many indigenous traditions, including the Aztec use of Oleuque, that physical toll wasn't a side effect. It was the point.
The suffering was the point.
It was viewed as a necessary threshold. The purging, the nausea, the heavy body load, that was the purification process. You had to physically cleanse yourself and endure the ordeal to prove you were worthy of receiving a vision or speaking to the divine.
Wow.
You couldn't just bypass the physical suffering to access the spiritual realm. They were intrinsically linked.
It's a completely different paradigm for altering consciousness.
Yeah.
The body isn't an obstacle, it's the toll booth. But since we are talking about this intense physical toll, if the body is going through all of this, the cramping, the cold extremities, is it actually doing permanent damage? What is the honest medical safety profile of this plant today?
The safety picture is complex. largely because of that ergot alkaloid nature we discussed earlier. The biggest inherent risk is that vasoconstriction.
Right, the restricted blood flow.
Exactly. Historically, sustained exposure to the ergot fungus on infected rye caused a terrifying medieval condition known as ergotism, or St. Anthony's fire.
I've read about that. That's where the blood flow gets restricted so severely that people's limbs literally developed gangrene and fell off.
Yes, which is horrifying. Now, to be clear, chewing a handful of morning glory seeds is not going to cause your arm to fall off. Ordinary use does not approach that extreme historical level of toxicity.
Good to know.
However, the biological mechanism is exactly the same. That feeling of cold, tingling limbs is genuine peripheral vasoconstriction. Because of this, consuming these seeds is highly dangerous for anyone with underlying cardiovascular disease or hypertension because their system just can't handle the restricted blood flow.
And the text mentioned a specific risk for pregnancy, too.
Absolutely. It is strictly contraindicated for pregnant women because these specific ergot alkaloids are uterotonic.
Meaning what, exactly?
I mean, they actively stimulate uterine contractions, which can induce early labor or miscarriage.
Okay, so there are inherent biological risks tied directly to how the chemical interacts with the body. But the article also points out a completely hidden modern danger that has nothing to do with the plant itself.
Oh, yes. This is crucial.
If you, as a listener, decide to go to a local garden center to buy morning glory seeds, those commercial ornamental seeds are often heavily coated with toxic chemicals.
That is a vital harm reduction point. Agricultural companies know these seeds have psychoactive properties. So to intentionally deter human consumption, they coat the seeds in fungicides, pesticides, and sometimes specific bittering agents.
So if someone tries to eat them, they're basically ingesting agricultural poison.
Precisely. Much of the acute, violent misery, the severe, unstoppable vomiting and toxic reactions that people report when trying to consume store-bought seeds comes entirely from those chemical coatings, independent of the actual LSA.
So you have a naturally occurring compound that causes severe nausea, constricts your blood vessels, and is often covered in literal poison to stop you from eating it.
Yep.
Which brings us to the legal status in the year 2026, because this is where our regulatory system just completely ties itself in a knot trying to categorize nature.
It is a textbook example of legal and regulatory friction. In the United States, if a chemist extracts and isolates pure ergin, the LSA compound itself, it is classified as a Schedule 3 controlled substance by the DEA.
Wait, I need to pause on that. Schedule 3. LSD is Schedule 1, which is the most restrictive category for things with no medical use and high potential for abuse.
Right.
So the government is saying the natural, nauseating, blunt version is actually a lower priority than the synthetic master key.
That is the logic, yeah.
Yeah.
Because LSA functions more as a sedative-type ergot alkaloid and lacks the potent hyperlucid activation of LSD, it isn't classed with the high-abuse hallucinogens in Schedule 1.
Okay.
But here's the bizarre paradox. While possessing the isolated compound is a federal crime, the plants and the untreated seeds themselves are completely legal to buy, sell, and possess as garden ornamentals anywhere in the country.
So wait, I can have a whole greenhouse full of Hawaiian baby wood rose vines. I can have jars of the seeds sitting on my kitchen counter. Totally fine.
As many as you want.
But the moment I try to actually use them, the moment I grind them up in a mortar and pestle or soak them in water to extract the chemical, I suddenly become a criminal.
Under federal law, the act of extraction or preparation for consumption crosses the line into manufacturing a controlled substance.
That is, that's like saying I can buy a bag of apples at the grocery store and that's perfectly legal. But if I go home, chop them up and bake an apple pie, I've just committed a Schedule 3 felony.
The apple pie analogy perfectly highlights the absurdity. This raises an important question about how our legal frameworks are designed in the first place. Modern drug laws were primarily built in the 20th century to categorize and control isolated synthetic compounds created in laboratories.
Right, they want a clear formula.
Exactly. They need a clear villain in a pill or a powder. The legal system consistently struggles to deal with naturally occurring botanical organisms. How do you effectively outlaw a flower that grows wildly in nature and has been part of human horticulture and indigenous spirituality for centuries?
You really can't.
You can't. And it's not just the U.S. struggling with this philosophical hurdle. The text notes that internationally, the laws are a complete patchwork.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In Germany, the seeds are entirely uncontrolled. They're just viewed as plants. but in countries like Australia, Italy, and Poland, have actually gone ahead and explicitly restricted or controlled the possession of Hawaiian baby woodrose seeds.
Because they got tired of the loophole and just decided to outlaw the plant itself.
Exactly. The confusion stems directly from the dual identity of the organism. To a suburban gardener, it's just a pretty blue flower on a trellis.
Yeah.
To a chemist, it's a structural precursor. And to a regulator, it's a massive, frustrating loophole.
So what does this all mean? We've covered a lot of ground today, from Aztec empires and Swiss chemists to rusty molecular peas, delirious stupors, and the weird world of modern drug law. If we distill all of this down for you, the listener, the big takeaway is that LSA is LSD's older, unrefined, natural relative. It is a physically demanding, nausea-inducing, heavily sedating compound with an incredible historical lineage.
I think it serves as a powerful reminder of how pharmacology actually works in the real world. The profound effects of a molecule are not just about its core structure, but the nuanced, often messy ways it interacts with multiple complex systems in the body simultaneously.
Right. Even if you never have the slightest interest in encountering a morning glory seed in your life, understanding LSA is a masterclass in the delicate nature of your own consciousness. It shows us that microscopic chemical changes, literally just snapping two tiny handles made of carbon and hydrogen onto a nitrogen atom, can be the entire difference between a sluggish, nauseating, heavy dream state and a hyper-lucid, world-shifting experience.
It really is amazing.
It highlights just how fragile and precise the machinery of the human brain truly is.
It is a profound demonstration of biological specificity. The keys must fit the locks perfectly to open the door to lucidity. Otherwise, you just remain stuck on the heavy threshold of the physical body.
Which leaves me with one final provocative thought I want you to mull over today. We know that nature originally evolved this complex ergoline molecule, not for us, but likely as a biological defense mechanism for a fungus or a vine, a way to deter insects or grazing animals from eating it.
Right.
Yet humans somehow discovered it, endured the physical sickness, and repurposed that exact biological defense to speak to their gods. What does it say about the underlying nature of our reality that the exact chemical keys required to profoundly alter human consciousness aren't just locked away in some high-tech Swiss lab, but are just lying dormant, waiting, right there in the soil of our gardens?
It certainly makes you look at a blooming trellis a bit differently.
It really does. Thanks for joining us on this journey, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.